Bob Segerson stepped down as the head boys basketball coach at Lima Central Catholic High School in 2010 after winning the Division III state championship, bringing an end to a legendary career that saw his teams compete at the state tournament on six different occasions. He spent his entire career at LCC, his alma mater, amassing 518 wins and 209 losses for a 71% lifetime winning percentage. And those numbers really don't matter, because the truth is Bob Segerson was a huge impact on me as a young aspiring coach, and I think has impacted countless other coaches during both his time and career as a coach and since he stepped away in 2010. This podcast is long overdue. I hope you enjoy my visit with former Lima Central Catholic head coach Bob Segerson. Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life podcast. I am incredibly excited. My guest today is former and longtime Lima Central Catholic High School head boys basketball coach Bob Segerson. Coach, there's a zillion ways I could start this, but I want to start just by saying, hey, thanks for agreeing to do this. I feel like it's long overdue. I won't get into all the reasons why it's been what it's been. People are kind of aware, but I appreciate you taking the time to do it, and I'm glad we're going to get a chance to talk.
It's my pleasure to do it, John. I really enjoy your podcast.
Well, I do appreciate that. Now, I said to lots of people that the podcast, what I envisioned when I started it was, we're just going to talk basketball, and it could go a lot of different directions. What ended up happening over the course of the first year of doing it, and it was really a handful of months that was really busy, because during the pandemic, nobody said no to a podcast, and you could talk to everybody. But the realization for me was that everybody's story is kind of cool. And if you've spent any time at all around basketball, you've got the basketball story, but the basketball story always bleeds into or is bled into by your life story. And you might have what I would say is as close to a unique tenure in basketball as anybody could have or as anybody I know, from the standpoint of lots of people grow up somewhere, go away, come home, and serve their community. Lots of people do that. Very few people do it for 32 years at the level that you did it, through the number of evolutions of things. I mean, and we've seen the game change in the 13 years since you left coaching in ways that I don't know we could have anticipated. And we certainly saw an evolution from 1970 to 2010 that was almost hard to even conceive of in a lot of ways. So there's a lot of different ways I want to go with this. And I gave you a little bit of an outline about where we would start, but I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curve, because you've done a lot of different podcasts. You've done interviews. You've written articles. People have all kinds of access to learn a little bit about you. So if I were a person who sees this podcast, says, hey, Bob Segerson is going to be on there, and they Google Bob Segerson, they're going to get any number of different profiles on you where they can read about you. What would be something that you would tell somebody who's reading a profile on you that maybe isn't in there?
Well, there's a lot in there, because I'll Google myself once in a while. A lot of it's baloney.
I do the same thing.
But the fact is, just probably that I came from a big Irish Catholic family, and that I had no intention of coming back. And, you know, I didn't see my life coming back here and spending my career here. It just shows how things can change. And basically that changed because of one person. And that was the principal and the founder of Lima Central Catholic. His name was Father E.C. Herr, kind of a well-known person in this community several generations ago. And he sat me down in the fall of my senior year. I was still playing basketball at St. Joe at the time, and convinced me that I would make a good teacher and coach. And he just had that kind of power. Mm-hmm. And he was an older guy then. He was in his 60s, but he saw something in me that I did not see in myself. And he was right. And so of all the basketball people that I can thank that contributed to my success in that area, the guy that really started it was a guy who didn't know basketball from a baseball, but knew people. And he kind of inspired me to go onto that track. And even when I didn't start coaching varsity until I was 30 years old. He talked me into it. And so the impact that I had didn't come from a jock. You know, it came from a 65-year-old priest who just new people knew how to motivate.
Well, that actually triggers another question that I didn't anticipate asking. And I'm familiar with your fondness for Father Herr, and that's something that people that are Northwest Ohioans are probably familiar with. And if they're outside of this area listening, There's a great story, many great stories about Father Herr's impact on Catholic education in general in our area, mm-hmm. and on you specifically. But so the question that comes to mind for me is, going to school under that kind of leadership, coming back to the area under that leadership and being impacted by him the way that you were, as you get later in your career, did you find yourself kind of having those same kind of feelings about certain people? You know, maybe being able to say, hey, I see something here that other people aren't seeing, or maybe this young man isn't, or young lady isn't seeing in her own self.
Well, John, I think anybody who's been successful as a coach or in the field of education, you know, either in the classroom or as an administrator, has the ability to see something in people and to convince them, you know, that power of persuasion, the gift of communication, and the gift of motivation. I think a lot of people in education who are good at it have that gift. You know, they see something in a young person that person doesn't see themselves. And I think you can paint that across a wide swath, and you can find a lot of these teachers in school systems, you know, high school systems all over the place. So
just for fun for me, when you look back on your time as a high school and college student coming to the end of that experience and being, as you said, it talked into teaching and coaching, the tools that you had, the skills that Father Herr witnessed were there. You were planning to apply them to, I mean, what would the path not taken? What would it have been had you not been talked into that?
Well, I was supposed to take the LSA, the LSAT, which is a law school. That was my major, pre-law history. And that's what I was kind of thinking. The Vietnam War converged at that time, too. Mm-hmm. And my number was 32 in the draft. And so I knew I was going to go. And I knew that there was no deferment for teaching at that time or for being in law school. And I thought, well, I'm going to get drafted here, so I might as well just start this teaching thing. It'd be a lot easier to leave that and then come back to something else. And what happened was I started and I kept waiting for that letter in the mail. The letter never came. And you know, of course, this would be the 71, 72 season school year. Mm-hmm. But I was convinced, you know, every time I opened the mailbox, I thought I was going to be getting a letter from Uncle Sam, but it never came. So I feel like I was just lucky in that regard.
Well, all of us who went into education had tough first years. Very few of us had that tough of a first year. Yeah. A little bit nervous about going to the mailbox. So yeah. When you got into teaching and coaching, talk a little bit about what your first assignment was. What did you teach? How many classes? And what was your coaching responsibility when you first started?
Well, I had a lot of responsibilities. In a Catholic school, one thing you have to know, you wear a lot of hats. And my first year, I was a JV football coach. I was a JV basketball coach. I was a freshman baseball coach. I taught civics and government, you know, and then I also was the head of the student senate and helped with admissions. So I was so burned out after 1 year, man. I mean, I needed a rest. But then I had to go back to school because I didn't have any teacher's license. And so it set me back to a master's degree program, which wasn't too bad. You know, that kind of got me licensed and everything. So it was the right path to take.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt it was the right path. But you mentioned it at the end of that first year. I'm going to assume, especially as a young person, there are a number of times during that you might say to yourself, is this the right thing? What else? I mean, did you start to consider other options in the midst of dealing with all of that responsibility?
I did not. I knew right away. I mean, I had dreamed about coaching too. You know, when you're an athlete, especially if you're a college athlete too, that's in every athlete's mind. And I think about coaching. And so it was in the back of my head. But once I started coaching, I was hooked. I mean, I liked working with that age, that adolescence, that teenage age. I mean, I was built for it. I didn't know it at the time, but I was. So I enjoyed teaching and coaching. When I retired, I said that, you know, I coached and taught for over 40 years. And I went and parked my car behind LCC for 40 years and walked in those doors. And there literally was not a day that I walked out that door that I wasn't happy to be there. I really liked it. It was a perfect marriage.
Well, all the experiences that you might have that people will relate to, that's one that a lot of people won't relate to. And I think there's tremendous value in it. I think we are in a culture sometimes, Coach, where bad days aren't permitted for people. Like if they have a bad day, that knocks them off their axis, so to speak. And you know, I've been in education 28 years, and there have been some bad days, but there's never been a day when I thought, I don't know why I chose this field.
Yeah.
There's just not been one. I mean, there have been days when I've thought to myself, I wonder what else I could have done, but I can't even really picture myself in another field. So I totally grasp what you're saying there. Now, this is a simple question, but I think it might not be a real simple answer because there's a lot of different ways it could go. But what was the hook for you with coaching? What gave you the bug, so to speak? Kids, X's and O's, camaraderie?
It wasn't the X's and O's, really. It was just the competition, I think. I loved competing even when I was a kid. I realized how much I liked to compete. And, you know, I had an experience in college. I played basketball at St. Joseph's in Indiana. And we had good teams. But then my senior year, we had this great team. It is a great ball club. We won the Indiana Collegiate Conference for the first time in the school's history. Beat Evansville twice. Beat Butler on the last second shot. Went to the NCAA Midwest Regionals and won. And that was just a great feeling, you know, to see everything come together. And so I'm not sure that that's not the feeling I chased when I got into coaching. It was trying to recreate the feeling that we had in that locker room. And coaches will relate to this. When you're winning and when you've got a team that's really shoulder to shoulder and nobody cares, they just want to win and everybody supports one another, you can't beat that. And that's kind of what I tried to create, I think, all those years while I was coaching. You know, I was chasing that feeling. You know, and I got it a number of times, and I really caught it in the last game I ever coached. And I still remember coming back to St. Joe on a Greyhound bus, teams in the thing. We had just won two games in a row to win that Midwest Regional crown. And sitting back and listening to some music and thinking, this is great. You know, just that feeling, I was worn out. I was exhausted because I'd played almost every minute two nights in a row. And school had never accomplished anything like this. And we were on the way to the finals and just sitting back and feel, you know, just being overwhelmed by that feeling, thinking this is the best feeling in my life. And it wasn't the best feeling, but it was close. And so I think a lot of coaches chase that kind of a dream because they felt it before. And I think that's a little bit of what juiced me, what gave me gas.
So based on your description of that moment and that feeling, I heard an expression once, and I've wrestled with it for most of my adult life. I heard a guy say once that there is no better feeling in the world than completely spending yourself in the arena of competition when you win. And the only thing that's close to it is doing the same thing when you lose.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not trying to, I hope this doesn't come off as pithy. You've experienced some gut-wrenching moments when everything in the moment was just what you described. The outcome wasn't what you would have hoped for or what anybody would have hoped for. What would be your response to a guy saying, making that? And I wish I knew where that quote came from, but I heard it years ago.
No, I think that feeling of satisfaction can come in a lot of different ways. I had a real low moment in sports years ago when I lost a game at state that I was ahead by 7 points with 35 seconds. It's kind of a famous game. It's a low point.
Relatively so, yeah.
Brought the kids home, left my family in Columbus. You know, I was just, they were down at the hotel and I'm by myself at home and I'm watching that replay on TV, which I shouldn't have done. I'm all by myself, turned the lights off, didn't answer any phone calls. So that's a low point. So I'm watching this game, I turn it off and think, what are you doing? And late at night, there's a knock on the door. And it's a player that I had kicked off the team like 5 years before and had not spoken to me in a long time. He, great kid, loved him, but had to do something. And that kid was at that door, he wanted to know how I was doing. That was a great feeling. So I experienced one of the lowest points of my career and one of the highest points of my career within about 2 hours of each other.
And fair to say, you don't get the high point in that moment without the low.
No, but you get to see, it's still what coaches coach for, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, that's, you know, again, another expression that's become prevalent in my life here and I've heard it before expressed in different, you know, using different verbiage, but the concept that's been emphasized to me over the last 10 years is in every dark moment, in every tragedy, whatever word you want to use, if you're patient long enough, the blessing will come.
Yeah.
And so that particular blessing of that contact with that player wasn't likely to have occurred without the dark moment right before it.
Right, right. And so I think every coach can relate to that. You know, there, and some satisfaction can come when you're not, when you don't have a great team. But you know, when you assess your team at the beginning of the year, you think where you can take them, right? Sometimes you achieve beyond what you thought was possible. And sometimes you achieve beyond what's possible with a team that really wasn't that good to begin with, but you still got them there. Well, there's a lot of satisfaction in that. Coaches know it. I mean, coaches know in a given year, you look around the area and the guys who are getting the awards are the guys that get their team to state or win the league and all that other stuff. But coaches know who really did a great job. And sometimes a great job is done by the guy that won six games. And you're thinking, how did he win six games with that group? I mean, coaches know. Coaches know who's doing the job.
Well, you know, I have a podcast that I recorded with Jim Clay. I don't know if you're familiar with Jim from Van Wert. Mm-hmm. Was in there. And we talked about, you know, difficult seasons and tough things. And look, Seg, this area has so many remarkable coaches that are incredibly successful. And we can throw out all the numbers for all the guys, the Arnzens and the Adamses and the Quartercracks and you name and your name. We might have just as many guys or close to it in this area who don't have those numbers, but they get blood out of turnips all the time.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great area for basketball, and it has been for a long, long time. The first eight tournament, eight in Delphus, were in it, 1922. And you go through the 20s and 30s, there's always representation from West Central and Northwest Ohio, always. There's always good ball clubs. And Lima, of course, has got a great history of basketball. And, you know, for these young kids, they got to understand, it didn't start like with Greg Simpson. I mean, it goes way, way back. And I try to hit that a lot in my column that I wrote for the Lima News. I love reading about past, but the success and the love and the passion for basketball that spread out through the entire West Central Ohio, that started a long time ago.
Well, I will tell you that I actually, on my way up here to do this today, I got a call from my dad, who's right now out of state, and I told him where I was going, and the level of enjoyment that he gets out of your recollection of this era, because he's a lifer here. I mean, Alger High School, and mm-hmm. he's been here his whole life, and has a lot to do with my love for basketball, but it's a very appreciated gift. But when I hear you talk about coaching the way you have, just in this 15 or so minutes that we've been talking, it creates a curiosity for me, because you said that you didn't become a head coach till you were 30 and you had to be talked into it. I'm not familiar with what it means to have that love for coaching and not wanting to be the head coach. Can you talk a little bit about your journey early on as an assistant and what maybe was, why didn't you want to be a head coach?
Well, I think part of it was not having the opportunity. When I came to LCC, they had a great coach, Joe Godfrey, who ended up coaching at Ashland and Southern Illinois and South Alabama. And then Bob Fisher and Jimmy Carter was the coach right before me. I didn't want to leave LCC. I could have left and applied for jobs. And when that job opened up, I saw a couple of the coaches before me, went through some heartache. You know, it's tough being coaching, especially if you're not producing, you know, winners, that type of thing. So I saw what coaches were going through. You know, to be honest with you, I spent almost 20 years at Five Star in Pittsburgh, and I had an opportunity to apply for positions on staff, some pretty good ones, actually. But all those years I was rooming with assistant coaches who had become head coaches or high school coaches who had gotten into college level. So I not only got to know them as when they were young, I got to know them as they assumed positions. They'd come through recruiting and we'd go out and have drinks and stuff like that. And I saw what they were going through, and it was not easy. And I didn't think I wanted to take my family on that ride. And so part of it was just the fear of the unknown. Do I really want to put my head on the neck, you know, my neck out there on the block? But I knew it was time. I knew that it was time to do it, and I had no regrets. And when I went into it, I went into it full bore without any reservations at all. I was really committed to it. I was passionate about it, and my family was with me the whole way.
After 40 years plus of doing it, and you know, the more than a decade since you've been away from it, this may be a bit of an unfair question, but can you recall anything, maybe a specific instance or two from the time when you were an assistant that you filed away as, that's how I want to do this, or maybe I know when it's my time, I'll do it differently than that?
Oh, yeah, I think everybody does that. You know, one of my inspirations for the way we played, what happened in 1971, my first year coaching, I was a JV coach, and our head coach, Joe Godfrey, took me up to see the Marquette Warriors play Bowling Green State University. Marquette was recruiting Joe Fisher, who was really hard. So we went up and sat in the first row behind the Marquette bench. Al McGuire's the coach, Dean the Dream Memminger, Jim Jones, McGuire's son, Allie. That was a heck of a team. They were number one in the country at the time. In fact, they were undefeated the entire season until they lost to Ohio State that year in the NCAA tournament. But I was mesmerized by Marquette and by Al McGuire. Now, mostly the team, how they played. They were just so disciplined. Their defense was unbelievable. Their offense was so unselfish that I just remember thinking to myself, I want to play this way. And he had taken players from the New York inner city, the Chicago inner city, and blended them with high school, Catholic high school kids, you know, and they were so disciplined, and they were just, they did. And he'd get in there, and Hank Raymond was his assistant. He was the X and O guy, but you know, Al was orchestrating the whole thing. And I was like, in the huddles, I was like, had my head almost in the huddle watching. And I just watched those kids in their eyes, and they never left McGuire. And I remember him calling a timeout late. They were up by 25 or 26 points. And Bowling Green got behind the defense twice for fast breaks. He called a timeout. He just reamed them. I mean, here they were number one in the country. They were already 30 points ahead of Bowling Green, but he let them have it. And they just, yes, sir, no, sir, like that type of thing. And I thought, that's how I want to play. And that became the team, that became the, like the blueprint in my mind of how I wanted my teams to play. And that's exactly what happened. That's how we played for most of my coaching career. That was what I had in mind. And then, of course, later on, my best player, Aaron Hutchins, he goes to Marquette.
Yeah.
I had already named my offense Marquette. And I got to meet Al. I went up for actually his last game, his senior year. It was the only time I got to see him play in Marquette. And I got to meet Al. I talked to him, and we corresponded by mail. But then he was a radio announcer at the time, so I got a chance to speak with him. And I'll tell you a funny story, John. I actually got to meet him after that game when I was 22 years old.
Wow.
So we went into the locker room, and Hank Raymond, who was in charge of the recruiting, he says, "Come back in the locker room." So we went in the locker room, and I noticed that McGuire wasn't there. And I looked out in the hallway. Down that long hallway in Anderson Fieldhouse by the locker rooms, he's back there smoking a cigarette. And there's like a big cloud of smoke right by him, you know, and he's just all by himself. And I said, "I'm going to talk to him." And I walked down there and I said, "Coach McGuire," I said, "do you mind if I ask you a question?" He goes, "No, what do you want?" He blows smoke at me. I said, "How do you do that? I mean, how do you get your kids to do that?" And he looked at me and he said, "They do it because I blankety blank tell them to do it." And I went, "Yes, sir." And I knew that was my exit stage left. So I left, but I told him that story years later. He laughed. And so anyhow, that in a real way, he was a real influence on me, even though it was just, you know, I just got to see him. But it inspired me, I think, in the direction I wanted to go with my basketball teams. It took a while to get there, but that was the blueprint.
Well, I am smiling at it and laughing through your explanation or description of that, because there's almost no parallel between what coaching has been in my life and what it was in yours. But what you just described about your experience at 22 with Al McGuire was a lot of my experience at 15, 16, 17 with you. I had my head in a lot of your huddles over about a 3-year window.
I know. I have to tell you the story. You and your brother would sit like two rows or a row behind our bench down at the old line of senior high.
As often as we could.
I had no idea who you were. And I remember asking my assistant coaches, who are those guys? It was like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when Butch says, who are those guys? I kept saying that to them. Who are these guys? Because not only were you there, you were like riveted on what was going on. And they said, well, that's the Cook brothers from Alger. From
Upper Soda Valley.
Yeah. USV.
Yeah. We you know, the funny thing is my I grew up with my dad as a basketball fan. And it's odd because I ended up an Ohio Northern student and I was on Coach Doherty and Coach Campoli's staffs as a student assistant for 4 years. I never attended an ONU game as a high school kid. I never did. But we played on Fridays and Saturdays. And on Tuesdays, there were a lot of opportunities. And we wanted to see ball. And I wanted to be a coach. And I was fascinated, I still am, about the personality once you take that crouch in front of your guys. Because it's not the same for everybody. And I didn't know what it was. And so what you described was kind of the same thing. Like, I can remember being a 16-year-old high school junior in December of my junior year, mm-hmm. which for you was a really good year because that's 1989. Oh, yeah. And we wanted to see that team as often as we could. And same thing, just, you know, so when you describe saying that's what I wanted us to be, you know, you weren't Al McGuire, but you had your own persona that you were completely comfortable with. Right. And you also, I think, did a masterful job from the perspective of a 17-year-old kid of being what you needed to be in a huddle from the standpoint of getting on somebody, from the standpoint of, you know, lightening the moment. If you felt like one huddle of yours that stands out, and I wish I knew who you guys were playing, but you opened the game and you didn't start very well. You took a timeout and we were there, guys come in and you just said, and you weren't loud about it. And you just said, we're not playing anywhere near hard enough. Our effort has got to get better. We've got to dictate to them a little bit. And we've got to raise our intensity because we're not being who we need to be. And you went on probably a 10-2 run or maybe a little more than that right out of that timeout. And then they took one. And you guys got back in the huddle and you crouched in front of your guys and you said, hey, that timeout, we just got – they're having this that one now. And so don't let them come out and punch back. And, you know, what was I, 16, 17 years old? I just filed that away. So hearing you tell that story I was struck by it. But you mentioned something during that conversation. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes here before we take our break. You mentioned being at 5-star. There really isn't anything like that that exists for young coaches today. You've told the stories a lot, so it's not something that people that know you well will be unfamiliar with. But how did you get to 5-star? What was your way in? And then, you know, what did it do for you?
Well, I got in because we had played Kettering Alder my first couple of years. They were loaded, and they had beaten LCC badly for about 4 or 5 years. Well, my first year there, we should have beat them at home. And then the second year, we went down there and gave them a great game. And afterwards, Joe Petroselli, who ended up becoming a mentor for me, stopped me and told me how much he appreciated how our teams were playing. And that meant a lot to me because I knew he was a terrific coach. That summer, he called me. He was on the staff at 5-star. He was one of the original high school coaches there, so he was in the family. And he said, I can't do these 2 weeks. Will you do it for me? And I said, yeah, I knew what 5-star was, but I really didn't. So I right. went over and worked. And the first year week I was there, Garth got mad at me because I picked a player named Jeff Lebo, who went on to be a pretty good player at North Carolina,
instead of a
guard from Indianapolis Cathedral High School named Smith, who was a big-time All-American, and we ended up losing the championship game by like a couple points. And afterwards, Garth came up, and he and I began a friendship, and he invited me back for the next 15, 20 years. And so that's how I got in. It was heaven. It was basketball heaven. This was before AAU ascended. And so the best players in the country were coming there. Now, the first, after about 5 years, ABCD camp started, Nike started, AAU ascended, and so it kind of faded after a while. But at that time, it not only attracted the best players, it was attracting the best coaches. And many of them, you know, my first roommate was Seth Greenberg. And I roomed with Brendan Malone, and whose son just won an NBA championship. And I mean, I could throw names out. And all of these guys were young coaches, and, you know, Calipari, getting to know them and see them move on. So that was fun. But I learned more basketball just in the lounge room at night drinking beers than I did going to clinics, because these guys were all pretty sharp. And so it was just it was basketball heaven. Everybody knew it. I developed a very strong relationship with Howard Garfinkel. I would say next to Father Herb, Garfinkel was a great influence on my life, not because of what he knew, but because of the people he put me in contact with. And so I learned a lot of, and not just from the college coaches, high school coaches as well, Al Rhodes over in Indiana, and Mo Smedley, two great high school coaches. I roomed with them a couple of times. They were great. So it was just a chance to be around basketball. And it was humbling too. It was very humbling.
It sounds like basketball nirvana, and I love it. So let's go ahead and take our break now, because when we come back, I want to talk about your head coaching experience at the start and get into some of that before we talk more specifics.
Okay.
I just want to take a quick second and interrupt the podcast for a minute to remind you that our new platform for the podcast is Spotify for Podcasters. And if you're listening on Spotify, you have an opportunity to make a donation to the podcast if you would be inclined to do so. Thanks for considering any sort of donation. One-time, monthly, or other regular donations are certainly welcome. Spotify for Podcasters is our platform, and they're providing an easy option for you to do so just by clicking the link at the end of the episode. Thanks for your consideration, and now back to the podcast. All right, Coach, right before the break, you had said several things that kind of triggered questions for me, and I was making notes. I'll get into some basketball stuff in just a second, but I want to talk about when you made the leap and you were going to become the head coach, your first year as a head coach. I think this is, a canned question, but I'm really curious about this. Knowing what you've explained about the program that LCC had before you became the head coach, when you walk into that, what's priority one for you?
Well, for me, priority one was adapting the program to the type of talent we were getting. And LCT was a strong football program. Paul Green was a coach. I was a very close
Paul Green. I'll be talking
about. Yeah, he was a terrific coach.
Paul and I go back a long way.
Well, and he, so I knew I was getting a lot of football players. So I knew we had to adjust to that. And in the first year, I think 8 of my first 9 were football players. By then, it was bumping into basketball, and so I didn't get them right away. So I knew I had to go defense. You know, I was going to take these athletes, and we were going to become a defensive program. We really weren't up until that point. And it worked that first year. We won, I think, 13 or 14 games my first year, which was a real surprise to a lot of people, including me. And it kind of fit in with what I wanted to do anyhow. And so I patterned a lot of my teams. We went to the defensive end of the floor first, and that never changed. All right. So that had a big impact. The other thing I noticed is that I didn't think basketball was like the number one love of a lot of these kids, which is fine. And so I wanted a vehicle where I could kind of inspire young players to really fall in love with the game. And so I started a basketball camp. The only basketball camp in the area, besides, I think Northern might have had one at that time, was Bob Arntzen had one over in Delphi. So mm-hmm. I went over and talked with him, and he showed me his stuff, and I said, I'm going to do this. And over the course of we started with 29 kids, but within 3 years, we had 100, and eventually 200, and eventually I had to shut it down. It became a popular camp. But the purpose of that camp, for me, in the beginning, was really not to teach skills, although we did do some, we did a lot of it, was to find ways to let these kids fall in love with the game. And they did. And we had a lot of fun in that camp, and those kids couldn't wait to get there. And we even had a newspaper that we would put out every day that they could go home and show their parents. And I'd stay up till 12 o'clock at night printing these little papers. And that was a goal of mine, and it worked. And I think it really had a lot to do with why the program, which was always good, just kind of moved up into a long-term next level. And it was because I think a lot of those kids, they really wanted to play basketball, even though they played other sports. I think that a lot of their heart was in basketball.
Well, Coach, I'm sure there is a remarkably long list of things that you did as a coach that are still the effects of those things are still being felt today. But if you didn't know this, there are high school coaches who run camps right now who still do newspapers and send them home with the players. My son brought one home a couple different times when he was a junior high and into high school, helping with the camps at his school. So there's value in that that I think it doesn't have a lot to do with just the game itself. There's value in it.
He didn't. I told the story. I'll tell it again. He didn't go to LCC, but Jamar Butler, I had to come back and speak to the camp. And he was a T-Bird camper when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Good player. Fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And at the time, he was going into a senior year at Ohio State University. And he did a great job with the camp. And then afterwards, Vince Cozy interviewed him. And he said, "What do you remember about T-Bird camp?" And he said, "What I remember about T-Bird camp is I fell in love with basketball at T-Bird camp." My eyes just got big. And I said, "There you go, man. That was the whole point. I wasn't trying to teach that kid a jump shot. I wanted him to have the opportunity to see how much fun competing could be, and basketball could bring you there."
So you're walking into the head coaching job. You've talked about the type of kids that you knew you were going to have. You know, we mentioned real early at the beginning of the podcast, X's and O's, and it not being a major factor in what drew you to coaching. But as you commit yourself to the defensive end of the floor, there's an X's and O's component to that, that even today, there are varied ways of doing things. And when I was, growing up in the early 80s and through the late 80s and getting exposed to basketball, there were, we're going to get up and contest everything and deny everything one pass away, or we're going to contest anything, guard to wing, but we're not going to contest guard to guard, or we're going to front the low post, or we're going to half front or three quarter. When you talk about the defensive end of the floor for you, break down how you prioritize the things that you wanted your team to get done defensively.
Well, we funneled things. That was one thing we did. I watched Bobby Knight's tape on defense, but the guy that really, really influenced me defensively was a coach at Miami named Hedrick, Daryl Hedrick, who was at Miami in the 70s. I was at a couple camps where his station was right next to mine, and I ended up looking at his station all the time because he was doing these defensive drills. He was a great defensive coach. And so we became big on the help line. Everything we did defensively was predicated on help. Now that changed a little bit now, because you put everybody on one side of the floor, they'll throw it over to the 3-point line, that type of thing. But at that time, we really emphasized help. And I really got into guys that they were not just one help away, but two help away, and denial and pressure on the ball. And Hedrick had that down pretty good. And it's interesting, I went down, he influenced my game. He didn't know how much influence he had on me. But my whole defense, a lot of it was Hedrick and Knight, but basically Hedrick. And 2 weeks ago, I went down and watched Cleo Vaughn be inducted into the Ohio High School Basketball, or the Ohio Basketball Hall of Fame. That's a really prestigious Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Cleo Vaughn, people in Langley will know, was a legendary name who was very influential in my life. And I went down there to that because I had never told him how much I appreciated what he did for me when I was a kid. And while I was sitting there, and I met his sons, and they knew, and we talked, and a big crowd, over 500, some big names in that place. I mean, that audience every year is,
I think Gail Doherty went in with that class.
And there's some great people in that place. And I'm looking around, and here's Daryl Hedrick. He's like four rows in front of me. He's 90 years old. And I thought to myself, here I am trying to say my thank yous to
to Cleo,
and here's Hedrick, four rows. And so during one of the breaks, I went over and I kind of knelt down in front of Daryl. I said, "Coach Hedrick, you don't know me." I said, "I coach at Lima Central Catholic." And he goes, "Oh yeah." And he knew a little bit about the program. And I thanked him for what he did, for how he inspired me defensively, and how most of my career was built on a lot of his philosophy on how to defend and where people should be, boxing out, that type of thing. And he just got the biggest smile on his face. And there was a couple of people with him. Some of his former players even had to help him up, to shake hands and stuff. But they sat back down. He got a big smile. And we ended up being together a lot that night. But it just gave me an opportunity to do that. So, from an X and O standpoint, especially defensively, we did not do a lot of pressure full court. And I had some athletes who could do that. But I was more, I was a control coach. My offense was very controlled. I let him out of the, I let him out of the barn the last 5 or 10 years I coached. But at that time, I was in control. I wanted to control the defense. If somebody scored from a breakdown of defense, I wanted to know who it was. I wanted to know why. And I wanted them to know why as fast as possible. And so it was kind of a controlled defense. It was also more physical because I had a lot of football players. And even until that last year, four of my starters were football players who had played football in December. And so we put our hands on you. And Bob Arnson's rolling in his grave right now. and he really lamented. But it started coming into the game when Bobby Knight got successful at Army and in Indiana. That became part of the game. Well, we took advantage of that. And we didn't grab people, but we were very physical on defense. And the other thing I discovered that was helpful was that in each step of the tournament, as you go through the sectional, then the district, then the regional, the state, every step you take, you can be more physical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially down at state.
You have to be.
Yeah. And if you're not, then you're going to get beat up by somebody. We almost got beat up by Oroville. We thought we were beating people up. But so that's what I would say about the actual X and O or strategy of defense. You know, I don't make any bones about it. People didn't beat a path to my door for X and O's. Because everything I had, I took from somebody else anyhow, including some of the local coaches. I got, you know, I used to steal from Ray Etzler all the time. We'd be beating him, but I'd be stealing his plays. I had a play called Ray. I had a play called Etzler. I had a play called Crestview. I had like five. I had to name them, and, you know, and he would laugh. So I stole most of what I got. But, you know, You talk well about X and O's. I know you can really dissect the game. I've heard you on TV. You do a great job of that. But sometimes what people forget is that when you evaluate a coach, the one ingredient they have to have is they have to be able to communicate with the age of the athletes they're doing, and they have to be able to motivate them. And that's not easy. And it's kind of a gift. And I know guys who could X and O all over the walls and tell you 15 offenses and 15 defenses to use against it and all that other stuff. But, you know, when it came to getting that information into players and motivating them, and they couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at all the successful coaches, some of them run different offenses, different defenses, they run, they control, you know, they're all over the place. But the one thing that great coaches all have in common, they can motivate. You know, and their kids will let them motivate, and kids will not let you motivate them unless they know that you care about them.
That's and a great, that's, great point.
That's the disconnect a lot of times, because Father Herr used to say, kids in high school, kids have an inborn crap detector. You know, sometimes they can't detect it in each other, but they can detect it in adults. And so, you know, you can get some coach who's really in it for himself, or, you know, something like that. Kids know that they don't go to the wall for those kind of people. I mean, so that's a very important note to make, is that that's a gift to be able to communicate to young people so that they understand what you're talking about, but also to motivate them to do things that they wouldn't do if you weren't standing there.
Well, and coach, also at the same time, once they know that's who you are and that the legitimate care is there, it opens them up to communicate in ways that maybe they wouldn't normally. I've had some pretty bad experiences in coaching, but one of the best ones I had was when I was coaching a team of guys, and we had really decided to focus on a core value approach, and evaluating ourselves on the things we said were important, not the scoreboard. We had a couple rivalry games that year that didn't go our way. And I was not handling it well. Those were games that mattered to me. Mm-hmm. I'm a competitor too. And my reaction in the post-game locker room, I got a response from one of the players who said, are you about the things you've been telling us you're about, or are you not? Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, that wasn't easy to hear, mm-hmm. but what I came away from that with is something's getting through, because he was willing to have that conversation rather than just tune me out and walk away,
right.
You know, or shut me out and shut down for the rest of the season. I think you're right. not only can you motivate them, can you speak to them, but they're also, it opens up lines of communication that I think are really, really valuable as well. So there's a couple things I wanted to get into with your team about the defensive side. I'm just going to make a comment. I always found it fascinating about your teams that you didn't press very much. Steve Willeman was a guy also who didn't press very much. But with both of your teams, when you needed to and you did it, it worked. Like you were good at it.
You know, I think the reason I didn't press too much is because I couldn't stand giving up a layup.
It sounds like Coach Doherty.
You know what I mean? I mean, that was just too much for me. My heart couldn't take it, even though when you press, you can get a few turnovers and you could trade 6 points for two. That kind of, I couldn't trade even 2 points. I could not even give you 2 points. And I was always worried about Ron Williams, who was my longtime assistant, great friend. His dad was my assistant at one time, too, a wonderful guy. We used to kind of argue on the sideline sometimes late in the game. We'd have a lead, and he'd say, you got to get some of these other kids in. And I go, wait. Now, we'd have like a 12-point lead with 2 minutes to go. And I'm like, oh, now, wait a minute. A
couple of threes.
I was always worried about the impossible, you know. And if I had one thing to change, I think I would have played more kids probably and let a few of them play earlier. That type of thing.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you named your offense Marquette, and I was actually hoping you'd bring it up because I couldn't figure out some non-corny way to say, hey, there have been continuity offenses for 100 years.
Yeah.
Flex was incredibly popular, right. The Van Wert stuff that Knopf's did, but what you guys ran was fairly unique. I mean, it was similar actions, but nobody really, I didn't see anybody else run it.
Well, what it was is I watched a game Marquette play one time, and it was the second time they played at Bowling Green a few years later, and the post guys were catching the ball on the wing and throwing it back out front. They were going in and running a pick and roll on the block, and then they were opening up on the block as a cutter came off. And
pin down on a quick seal.
So basically what we did is we just kept running that on each side of the floor, and then reversed the ball on a down pick and just ran Marquette on the left side of the floor. But we could run that thing in our sleep. And the thing I liked about it is it moved the ball from side, top, top, side, side. So we moved the ball back and forth. Plus, I controlled the game a little bit. And if it was a situation where the other team was just really hot and we were having trouble stopping them, I could run that thing for 30 seconds or 40 seconds even, just to kind of slow things down. Let's get this thing back under control. The other thing I did, and my players knew this, is great players could break that offense any time they wanted to. And I was blessed with great players. You know that.
Absolutely.
And they knew that they had the red light. If you could get to the rim, get to the rim. I don't care where we are in this offense. If you get somebody out of position or something, go to the rim. And they did. So even within Marquette, there was, I tried to structure freedom as well. And we ran that thing so long that there were teams that could run Marquette better than we could, scouting,
But it was the design of it. It was the pin in with the quick seal inside. Right. And then that was followed basically by kind of a shuffle cut as the ball was being reversed. Yeah, there were actions that were hard to guard that if you, as you said, side, top, side, right, two or three times, there's a pretty good chance somebody's making a mistake, even if they know it.
Yeah.
And I saw Matt Tabler run it with his Perry guys in about 2014-ish.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I had seen it in a long time. But, we're in an era now where continuity offenses have kind of gone by the wayside, except it seems like a lot of people run this, the ball screen continuity is really popular.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's not as tough to defend as what that stuff may be if you go back to it.
Yeah. Well, I ran that thing probably from 1978-79 season till probably the early 2000s. And then I kind of went to more of the outside spread type thing as people began using the three-point line more. And I would have alumni games, which were very popular. We'd do it over Thanksgiving. And the guys who would come back, they'd all run Marquette. They'd be out of school for like 10 years, but they could run Marquette,
Sure. Well, we got about 12, 13 minutes left here, and I told you I wanted to ask you a couple of kind of basketball intersecting with life type questions. So you had shared with me that you got married at 27, became the head coach at 30. I've never heard a successful coach with a successful marriage that didn't describe his wife as a superhero or a rock star.
Yeah, well, she was all those things. She kept things in perspective for me. She was not a big jock lover. I mean, she didn't marry me because I was a jock, let's put it that way. So she would put things in perspective for me. And I was, I made sure there was time for her. And she made sure of that too. So no, she was remarkable in her, the other thing, your family will hear the stuff in the stands, but they don't tell you about it. You know what I mean? They hear that kind of stuff, but she was always very, very cool about it. She would not mention it. Somebody else would sometimes, because every coach hears it, but are, from somewhere. And no, she was great. It might've been why we waited to 27 to get married. Is I think it was because she wasn't sure that I was kind of a jock, even though I wasn't coaching at varsity at that time. I was doing a lot of coaching. Mm-hmm. But it worked out great. And I had a chance then to, all three of my kids were a part of the program at one point. My oldest son played for me on a couple of those really good teams. He was on the team, and my daughter was a cheerleader, and my youngest son, who did not play basketball, kept the scoreboard type thing, mm-hmm, for our game. So it was, those were really the best years when they were all involved. That was fun.
I can't really conceive of that, because I in my coaching experience, I missed my kids, except I coached my son when he was a senior.
Yeah, that was
funny. Very unexpectedly. And it was. I wouldn't trade it. It actually makes me a little bit envious of the guys who got to do it for 3 or 4 years or their son's entire career. I had a priority for my son as he was growing up, was that I wanted him to play for other people, mm-hmm, in every sport. I wanted him to be coached, and I right, wanted him to learn how right, to deal with coaching. And, right, and, but having done it for a year, mm-hmm, he may have only been able to stand it for a year. I would have loved, now looking back on it, the opportunity to do it for longer than that. We talked about how much the game has changed, and from the time you started till you finished, and since you finished, Coach, I just feel like right now when I watch basketball, basically everybody kind of plays the same way.
Yeah, I get the same feeling. It's a 3-point line. It's all about the 3-point line. I don't think anybody had any idea how dramatic that impact would become. But it's interesting. I love talking to old timers, many of them gone now, about basketball and their generation. Tom Williams, for instance, who played in the late 40s in high school and the early 50s at Ohio State. And I would ask him, he goes, basketball when I played is nothing like the way it is now, and this would be in like 1970 when, mm-hmm, he's telling me this. Well, now I find myself saying the same thing. So it definitely is it's a chronicle of change. But we have to keep in mind, I'm not preaching, but there are some things that do remain the same that basketball and athletics cannot lose. If you get a team from the 1950s, that 48 St. Rose team that played for a state championship, or my high school team or your high school team or, any team, and ask them, professionals, ask Bill Russell, ask Bird, ask them what do they miss? What did you learn at that? So the first thing they all bring up is friendship. All right. They talk about friendship, and then they talk about having to overcome something, that resiliency, that idea of having times when it just didn't look like it was going to work. And then all of a sudden they stayed with it and it worked. And, they talk about, the discipline they learned, that type of thing. Very few of them talk about their individual accomplishments. Some of them do. And so the one thing that goes from the 1920s when Ada and Delphus made it to the state championship all the way to today, the game has changed. But the real rewards of athletics should not change, even with the NIL, even though the kid that doesn't get a scholarship, that doesn't make all city, that type of stuff, that kid has an opportunity to get the same gifts and the same rewards that those guys in the 30s and 40s and 50s and say all the way up to now are getting. And hopefully that doesn't change, and that we don't get sidetracked with all the money that's being made down and all the effort on putting all the best athletes on one team and that type of thing. We can't lose that, and I don't think we will.
No, I agree with you. We won't, if the guys that should be the guardians of the game really take that seriously. And I think particularly around here, I think they do that. And I would guess by and large on a national scale, they probably do too. So you've been away from, I say, your program. I mean, 32 years as the head coach and 518 wins. And all, I mean, it was your program. Mm-hmm. And you've watched from a distance, but not a great distance. You've stayed relatively close to the program. I got a couple of questions that kind of are married to each other. One, now that you've had some separation from it and knowing what we just discussed about the game, if you were back on the sideline for one season, would 32 minutes of LCC basketball look differently today if you did it than it did when you left in 2010?
Well, yes. I mean, I wouldn't put them in Marquette offense. They would be playing defense every possession, I can tell you that. So I don't know what it would look like. When Frank took over, he was my assistant for 9 years, and he did a great job. So I wouldn't change a thing there. I think Sean Powell, who's taken over now, I think he'll do a great job. But I thought to myself many times, first of all, that possibility of happening isn't going to happen. But
I can dream, can't I?
I thought that before, John. I thought, what would I do? And I'm not sure what I would do. The game has changed so much. And maybe it's me, you know, to get off my grass type of thing. But I don't enjoy it as much watching what they're doing now. It's all spread out. I saw a player with a chance to tie a game in a pro game with a layup, stop, and drove back out to three to try to win it instead and missed a three, and then they lost the game. I mean, I thought that was, wait a minute, you know, at what point do the statistics take over? But I don't know. I think I would be able to talk with young people. I think I would be able to communicate and maybe build an atmosphere of winning. But how I would begin to play the game, I would have to retool a whole lot of thinking in my head. What I would do is go out and find some young guy that knows all that stuff and be kind of like be the Hank Raymonds to me. And but it is, I don't want to say it's disappointing, but the game is evolving as it has from the very beginning. I mean, just think about those guys who are shooting set shots at one time, and you know, there were no minorities in the game, and then all of a sudden that now there's a three-point line and people are jacking threes and they're making them.
Yeah,
and these young kids are making them. I've got kids down in that play ball down in Columbus, and I've gone down to watch some workouts and summer stuff. And I sat there and I watched this one team make like five or six straight threes. They were like sixth graders going into seventh grade. They were making threes like they were like no tomorrow.
And that's why it's not probably going to go away. But I will say this, from watching your teams as a young guy that didn't know bleep from apple butter to a guy that I think, you know, had studied the game enough to know, your teams got to the paint. Your teams got easy baskets. One of the things that always struck me about your team is even if you spread the floor and you were trying to burn clock, if they gave you a layup, you took it. Yeah. It didn't matter what the time or score was. So easy baskets, getting in the paint. You guys shot a lot of free throws. All of those things would fit extremely well with the game today. Yeah. And I always like to ask coaches who've been at it a little while, how much fun would coaching have been with if you'd have had the resources that exist today? You know, websites, online clinics, daily emails that come to you with X and O suggestions. I mean, it feels to me like if you, a guy like you, came back, you need about 2 weeks to just get a handle on the four or five resources you really want to study, and you'd be good to go.
Yeah, I thought about that on the way over here. I was on my social media, and there was a bunch of basketball stuff and plays and everything else. I remember when I first started coaching, Champion used to do a summer little booklet of all the drills and stuff that people did in their clinics. And I used to, that was like a Bible to me. I'd look through that. Well, that was big time then. Yeah. Now you can go home and find out, you can find whatever you want. And that certainly is a big change. You know, the other thing that gets lost in this is in teams and coaching that I always thought is that not only does a coach have to be the leader, when you have leaders in your team, that can make all the difference in the world. When you see a team that underachieves, you know, really with a lot of talent, but still just underachieves, a lot of time you look on the team, there's just no leaders. Mm-hmm. And people forget that it's not an alpha dog leader. it's not one person. It's, you got to have a lot of leaders. And if I look back at my teams, I do this sometimes, you know, I kept a journal of every team I ever had, and I like to look at those. I marvel at how many of the really great teams I had, they had a bunch of kids who were leaders. I never had to worry about the locker room. I mean, they were just leaders. That last team I had, that 2010 team, there were a bunch of leaders on that team. You know, nobody cared. Nobody got jealous. You know, they got in the locker room and nobody was mad at each other. They were just leaders, and they continue to be leaders, you know, in their lives. And now it's been 12, 13 years. They're in their 30s now, the kids on my last team. And so many of them are successful is because they understood that leadership. And it can't be stressed enough that you can be the greatest coach in the world, but if you don't have talent and if you don't have some leaders in the locker room that take care of that, then you're not going to be successful. You're just not going to win like you should.
Coach, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time. I could do this for another hour, but we're getting right up against an hour, and I want to respect your time. But I genuinely appreciate it. You talked about having the chance to thank some people that maybe didn't know that they had an impact on you. I'm disappointed I can't claim the coaching resume that I'd like to have, but you were a huge influence on a young guy that wanted to be a coach, and I'm thrilled we got to do this.
Well, I appreciate it. I enjoy your podcast immensely, and I enjoy listening to it. I'm glad you started it back up, John.
We'll catch up again soon, Coach. Thanks. All right. Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and checking this one out. If you're listening on Spotify, courtesy of our platform, Spotify for Podcasters, you have the opportunity to make a donation to the podcast. If you would be inclined to do so, there's a link at the bottom of the episode that will allow you to make your donation in whatever amount you would choose to do so. If you're listening on any other platform, I just ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe, and come back anytime to check out more episodes here on the Basketball and Life Podcast.